98.5, the all-new Wires Promise. State Attorney Ayala is our special guest this morning. We have some time to, first of all, thank you for joining us and being accessible to, you know, answer some questions. How are you today?
I'm good. Good morning, and thank you for having me. Glad to be here and glad to be able to answer some questions.
Well, first of all, what do you expect's going to happen? You just filed a case less than 48 hours ago against Governor Scott. What are you seeking, and how soon do you think you'll get a ruling on that?
Well, procedurally, there's some time that they're going to give the governor and the attorney general to respond. I think there's a two-week period. Then we have another 2 weeks to answer, reply. But I'm expecting exactly what I filed on. I believe what the governor has done is abuse his authority by inserting himself. And I'm going to continue to believe that the authority vested in me by the Florida Constitution and the people who voted for me still remain. So I'm expecting a positive outcome that restores my prosecutorial authority.
What factors contributed to your initial decision not to seek the death penalty?
Well, there's a lot of factors. It wasn't an easy decision, let me say that. And I based it on a lot of data and me looking deeply into the issues. I started off my career in criminal justice, in criminal law. I served as a prosecutor, a public defender. I have been a law professor. I've been an adjunct professor in a legal studies department. I've been a legal analyst. So it comes with a lot of history of me being deeply embedded and invested in the criminal justice community. So when I took office, I looked at the things, and as you just asked me, what did I consider? I considered my experience. I considered, in addition to my experience, I considered the current state of death penalty in Florida, which has been in extreme turmoil. I mean, we're in a situation where the death penalty in Florida has been stricken down twice as unconstitutional, meaning that our death penalty statute here in Florida has been said to be unconstitutional twice in less than a two-year period. And from January of 2016 all the way until March 13th of this year, we didn't even have a constitutional death penalty statute. When I took office on January 3rd, it was unconstitutional at that time, and there were multiple cases, some that had been around since I was 2 years old, that were in my lap because they were unconstitutional death sentences.
Wow. Hey, here's a question. We got some questions from some of our listeners. Have you communicated and revealed your biases against the death penalty before taking office?
You know, when it comes to the issues of the voters, I definitely understand and empathize with their concern and their position. And what I can say is that when I was running for office, and even when I started and took office, I expected to, I was prepared to pursue death penalty. I didn't have a personal bias that would prevent me from pursuing what was in there. And when I took office and looked at the problems that were not articulated by anyone who sat in this office before me or any other prosecutor throughout the state, I was realistic about where we were. And the one thing that I stayed true to the voters, are the things that I promised, that I would bring new data-driven approaches to the office, that I would be committed to dealing with racial disparities, that I would talk about my decisions and have evidence-based policies and have integrity. Those are the things that I had to keep in mind of the promises that I made the voters when I got hit with this in the day one of the office of what was I going to do, especially because death penalty, as I recall, never came up as a discussion during my campaign. And again, I'm not surprised because we did not have a legal death penalty statute during 2016 when I ran. So again, I understand the concern. But what I want to keep everyone, what I want to make very clear is that my intentions on having evidence-based policies and being straightforward and transparent and having integrity, that's how I got to this decision, and that's why I began to study and come up with a policy and a response to this problem based upon my promises to the voters.
I know you've looked at all the stats and number. What's the difference in the closure for families versus, you know, the costs and time of incarceration and then retrying the death penalty? What have you seen up close by, you know, from your view?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing that I've seen as it relates to families is that some of them have the feeling that they don't want to see death. They're ready to close it. There's other families who absolutely want death. But of those families who want a death sentence, it's because they want the idea of what we think death penalty is, not the reality of what death penalty is. Most people are under the false assumption that, you know, after you have the guilt phase and the person is found guilty, then we go to the penalty phase and they're sentenced to death, then it's done. But the truth is, me being on the inside and what I want to educate as many people, that's not the end, that's the beginning. That is the beginning of decades of appeals. That's the beginning of tax dollars going to pay for all of the appeals that last years and years and years. And every time a case is brought back on appeal, if it's a high-profile case, it's back into the news. The families don't get the closure. So, again, it's not necessarily what they want, because I can't promise them what it is that they want. They want an immediate death sentence where they can get the closure faster than we have a system that allows that.
And that will never happen. Some say that you violated your oath of office in attempting to change the policy regarding the death penalty. How do you see it as a law enforcement official?
Well, when it comes to the law, I've absolutely not violated any laws. There's no basis, and as a matter of fact, when the governor issued his executive orders, if it is reviewed and if you listen to any interview, there has been no substantive law that has been cited as in violation of what I've done. What I can tell you is that as a prosecutor, I took an oath to uphold the laws of this state. And that's what I've done. I've done it through my career. I continue to do it. And I did, in this situation, I did what prosecutors in this state and across this country do every single day. And when it comes to prosecutorial independence and discretion, that is granted to prosecutors in the Constitution and been continuously upheld over and over again. It is a situation where we have to have discretion to do what we do. And at the end of the day, the state isn't ever even required to charge someone, let alone to seek a particular sentence. We have to consider so many different factors that we have to have a level of discretion that allows us to effectively do our job. It is not creating law. That is a misrepresentation. It is administering law. And I have to be certain in my position that I am administering law effectively and justly. That is my responsibility. So when I look at the administration of it, I am required to consider the state of the law. I'm required to consider the wishes of the victims. I'm considered to look at the trends on particular sentences, specifically death penalty. There are so many considerations that I have to, including the cost. So in my position, I have to be able to have discretion, and that's exactly what the Constitution of the United States and of the state of Florida have authorized and allowed and acknowledged, which is why I ended up filing a lawsuit.
When you first brought this up, I read a New York Times article, and you know, the headline said this was a bold move. Why for you, it seems like an easy move that, I mean, you passionately believe in what you're doing. I've heard all the naysayers saying that you were bought by George Soros and this is his thing. Could you please dispel those rumors? Because I know from your heart that you believe this, and this is not about money. This is not about election promises. This is from your heart.
Well, absolutely. I'm always happy to answer that question, because the truth is, I don't think voters are dumb. Voters can read people. Voters can understand, and I'm not afraid to look anyone in their eyes and tell them where this came from. I would just ask the community and the voters to remember that when I started my campaign in March of 2016, I was handing out cards of telling people how to pronounce my name. I was going door to door. I was showing up at people's churches, their community events. It didn't matter. I was on social media trying to let people know what I stood for, that I stood for integrity, that I stood for criminal justice reform, that I was trying to have a holistic approach to prosecuting while simultaneously keeping the community safe. I wanted to build the relationships between law enforcement and the community, because I value this community, and I also value the work of law enforcement officers who put their lives on the line every day. These are the things things that I stood for when I put my name in to run in March of 2016. And it continued through March, April, May, June, all the way through. And while I was campaigning, I campaigned on that platform. And at the end of the day, when you have a person like Mr. Searles who is looking at several different candidates, and I happen to be one of them, I can tell you that my platform from the day I started to the day I was victorious never changed. My rhetoric never changed. It's never been bought. There's nothing behind me but truth and justice. And for the record, I will make it very clear, I don't know George Soros. I've never met George Soros. I've never talked to him. I've never sent a message to him. He's never sent a message to me. And most importantly, I've made absolutely no promises to anyone other than the voters of this community of how I will handle this office. And that's what I will continue to do.
I appreciate that. That sounds as real can be. How long do you think this battle's going to take? The bus ride a couple of weeks ago to Tallahassee, and you have a lot of supporters. A recent poll said 61% of Florida voters are against the death penalty. And why do you think this is such a problem in this state, getting from where the voters think to legislation and changes in policy?
Because at the end of the day, we're so deeply embedded and committed to the death penalty. And Furman v. Georgia, which is the United States case in the 1970s that struck down death penalty in this country, Florida was the first state to bring it back and make it legal again. And we have been doing whatever we can to make it work and never questioning it. And I believe, as I said, the things that I promised on the campaign trail, that we do need to question things. Are we doing what is right? Are we being productive? Are we being humane? Are we being decent? Are we administering justice in a way that shows this community what they want and what they care about actually exists? So I just think it's so deeply embedded in the power structures that we have not been willing to even question what we do.
Yeah. I know you've been getting, you know, a lot of positive support, but then the negative stuff, death threats, and, you know, Judge Salam up in New York was found murdered yesterday. I mean, what type of pressure is that on you and your family dealing with something like this?
Well, first, let me acknowledge the supporters first, and then I'll get to the others. The buses to Tallahassee, the constant comments on social media, the letters that I'm receiving, the stance of this community is one of the most amazing things that I have seen in my career. People have something to stand for. They're uniting on an issue, and it is making this community and me even personally proud. I want to say thank you to those people who have spoke up, who have done something, and even those who have kept it quiet in their hearts. Thank you for standing on the side of what is right. As it relates to the others, those who I have gotten a lot of I have gotten a lot of pushback. I received a noose that was mailed to my office. Received several types of derogatory and racist remarks to me personally and professionally. At the end, comments about my children and people's wishes for their safety and their well-being, I handle it by being right. At the end of the day, I can only stand for what is right. And if I will buckle because of a threat, the threats will continue. And I'm not going to encourage anyone to continue to threaten what is right. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether I stand or whether I sit down. This issue continues to still to remain a topic, and that is what needs to happen. I don't need to be the face of this. I don't need to be the voice of this. This community needs to readdress how we are sentencing people and how we are handling criminal justice in this community. And the legislature, fortunately, they're beginning to look at this, and we need to be evidence-based in how we are pursuing criminal justice in this community.
I wanted to ask, is Governor Scott affecting your office now? I've been hearing about budget cuts and some of your folks leaving and the pressure. Is anything internally happening that folks don't know about?
Well, I can say that it has been challenging when you have your authority attempting to be usurped by the governor, then it has those who you have, you know, in your office who are your employees begin to question you. So it's absolutely been challenging. The reality is that the Supreme Court has the ultimate say, and that's what I rest on. Internally, the turnover is natural whenever there's a new administration that comes in. There were some who didn't join our administration, and there are some that once they're in here, they desire to go a different way. And I think that everyone has their own professional goals, their political goals, and whatever that they have in mind. That doesn't impact me. I have been in office for less than 6 months, and I'm going to continue to focus on the promises that I made. So that's internally in the office. Now, budget-wise, it is true that the legislature has pushed back and tried to make this a bigger issue with the initial attempts to cut my budget $1.4 million. The reality is, of all the cases we handle in this office, less than 0.01% are death penalties. So that creates a bigger issue of what are you really trying to cut the budget for? And the reality is that $1.4 million was given to this circuit to establish human trafficking and domestic violence. Upon taking office, I immediately put together a domestic violence unit that has been in effect. I've also increased our human trafficking. What, as it relates to domestic violence, in the 3 months since I have started our domestic violence unit, there's been a 13.5 increase in domestic violence as cases filed. We've also had a 7.8 decrease in those cases that are being dropped. So we are being effective with the money that was granted. And a lot of times we use the concept of human trafficking and we just blow it off because we're not personally affected. But we have to realize here in the Ninth Circuit, human trafficking is a problem. Even though Orlando, this area, is one of the biggest tourism spots, and it's a prime, it is also a prime location for human trafficking. And in Orlando, we rank third in the nation and number one in the state for human trafficking. So we have to be doing something, which is what I began to create and build in the Ninth Circuit Human Trafficking, the unit that we built. It is the only one of its kind in the state of Florida. Wow. So the money that people are trying to impact and saying it's death penalty, they're actually impacting other issues. And the one thing I want to remind everyone, when it comes to the need for domestic violence specializations and units in this office, if we think about this large case that is all over the media right now, it started from domestic violence. And if we can get it at its root, we can begin to heal this community.
Just a couple more questions. Did Governor Scott talk to you before his decision or after? Did he ever get on the phone and talk to you or set up a meeting?
He did not. I first learned about him attempting to, his request for my recusal. First time that I heard that was through the media. My PIO, Erica Washington, received a call for me to comment on something that I had not even been aware of. So I thought the professional thing to do as elected officials that we communicate. So instead of me responding, I reached out to call him. And ultimately, I did speak to him, and I told him very clearly that I'm calling before I respond in the media because I think that's the professional thing to do. But I also want to discuss with him how I arrived at my decision. I plan to discuss with him all the things that I just discussed with you about the evidence-based policies, about the dangers, about victims being on hold, about the misrepresentation of what death penalty really is in Florida. I wanted to have that discussion with him. Instead, he declined and immediately said the only question he had for me was I going to recuse myself? I said no, and the conversation ended.
Wow.
Shortly thereafter, he issued the executive order, and once again, we found out that through the media. So it's been a communication issue, an overreach issue, and I'm looking forward to the Supreme Court resolving it.
Hey, let's get to where we're at, right here in Pine Hills. We're on Silver Star Road, right off Pine Hills Road. This community, since we launched the station on October 28th, we've had at least 15 or 16 murders within a 4 mile radius. Mm-hmm. What do you think can change? And I know this is beyond you and law enforcement, but as a community, What can we do to make your job easier?
Well, part of it is one of the things that I instituted when I took office was a community outreach division. And there was always a disconnect in prosecutors and the community. Some people didn't even know what state attorneys did. So I thought that it was important to make certain that we had people in the community connected to our office so that when we are prosecuting cases, that we're getting people to court to testify, that if they're afraid, they have someone to talk to about their concerns. You know, do we need to appeal to the legislature for witness protection? There are so many different reasons that people don't come to testify, or they change their stories, and we want to eliminate that so that the people who are living peacefully and love their community in Pine Hills and raise their families there, that they can continue to live in peace. So it's about being involved with us being involved with you all. When you are a part of a case, you become present, you testify, and then again, not limiting our conversation to the dangers, but focusing on celebrating the victories that we do have. I was excited to go through Pine Hill when I was campaigning, and I met so many amazing people, and those are people I remain in contact with today. So learning to focus in on the good and let our office eliminate the bad, then we can all learn to live peacefully and in a safer community.
Well, we truly appreciate you joining us here at 98.5 The Y, State Attorney Ayala. Final question. Are you a hip-hop fan or R&B fan?
Am I a hip-hop or R&B?
Yeah. You got any favorite groups?
R&B.
Okay, well, just name one of your favorites. Something that makes...
Oh, my God.
Come on.
Obviously, I grew up on Boyz II Men, New Edition. I'm a Tyrese fan. I love Alicia Keys. I enjoy music. That is one thing that I do enjoy. I love gospel music, but I do love R&B as well. I love Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson is the man.
Yeah, Charlie is one cool guy. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on 98.5 The Wire. Anytime you need to give a voice, you got a home here at 98.5.
I recognize that and I appreciate it. Thank you so much.